Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
We just watched Season 5, Episode 3, titled High Sparrow. What do you think of this episode, Aaron?
So, yeah, I try to be fair to the show a lot of times, and I'm skeptical of a lot of, like, the true fan, you know, like, last year there was a near riot about the wording Littlefinger used before he threw his
ridiculous
sister off of the, out the moon door.
Uh-huh.
Not sister, his wife, sister wife, whatever. the crazy 9-year-old milk feeder.
Yeah.
There's some things like that where, you know, I've kind of been disgruntled with, and I'm like, okay, well, whatever. And I'm not sure why the Double D's chose to change the wording, because I do think it's more elegant in the book. And there's other times where it's like, well, I feel like they've simplified things down to where it would be just as easy to tell the fuller story in just as much time. And for some reason, they don't. Like, one of the big things was John and the Corrin Halfhand plot where, you know, he forced John to kill him so he could get in good at the wildlings. That happened in a lot more satisfying way in the books. And it was just something missing in the show. This is the first time where I have been looking forward to John lopping off Janos Slynt's head.
Yeah.
And in the book, it just happens so much more. It's essentially the same thing, but John's going to have him hung. And he's going this like, okay, oh, you can't scare me, I have friends. And when you're reading the books, John has a change of heart, like as he starts to get his head in the noose. And he's like, I'm a lord, I can't. And he's like, you're right, we won't be hanging you. And then Janos starts to smirk and he says, you know, Ed, fetch me the block. And then realize you're right. You are a high lord. I shouldn't be hanging you. I should be taking you off your own damn head off with my own sword. And it's a crowning moment of awesome. This, if you didn't know, I mean, I don't know. How did you, as a show watcher, how did it feel to you? Like, did that feel awesome?
I don't know that would have felt any different to me. Because I got all those same sensations that you're talking about. Like, Janos Slynt was, you know, an insolent little asshole the entire time. He's a coward. He's afraid. What he admits at the end is true. He's always been afraid. But maybe it was less here about, you know, him wanting to, like, prove a point to Janos as well.
Uh-huh.
But when Janos confesses that he's afraid and he's derelict of duties during the battle, I felt like John can't tolerate that. John at that point was like, you know what? I was afraid. My father was afraid. Everyone is afraid. They all did their jobs. Fuck you. Off with your head.
And honestly, when Janos said mercy, you know, that was clearly to, like, this is another test. Like, oh my God. And oh, Stannis is watching. And that was all fine. I just felt like it felt rushed. And again, as a book reader, I was expecting the one thing where we had this natural kind of like crescendo and then the false crescendo and then the climax. And this is a big moment, and I don't know, man. It's like maybe it had 30 seconds to scene, maybe a whole minute, and maybe that's the whole thing. But damn, like when you get a chance to swing for the fences on a big line like that, I mean, that's like the line Jon Snow gets in the whole series. I'm a little let down, and that happened fairly early on in the episode, and it kind of carried, you know, again on my first watch, that kind of sense of bummer felt follow me through the episode. And
Sucks. This episode is fucking dreary, man.
I was about to say,
like, the past couple of episodes, you know, you've had scenes in the Water Gardens, and you've had scenes in King's Landing where it's bright and it's, you know, as cheerful as King's Landing is gonna be. This just felt dark and dreary the whole time. I mean, everything is just like stone and heavy and dark. Yeah, I wasn't really feeling much of this episode. I thought a lot of cool stuff happened, and a lot of good plot movement and stuff, but
a lot
the
of pieces,
tone of it was just
A lot of pieces have been set on the board, and I feel like they've been doing that the last two episodes, but now things are actually moving.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
so many things are happening radically different. Everything with Brienne, we already talked about Jaime, everything with Sansa and even Littlefinger. And I'm starting to see how maybe all this stuff is going to reconnect. But yeah, you're right. I mean, visually, this episode looked like that moat Kaelin said. It's just a big mud hole. Foggy brown mud hole.
Most of it.
And, you know, it's like you're down into dungeons of the House in Black and White. You're down into, you know, I mean, Winterfell looks like a shithole now.
Everything. Everything just looked dark. I mean, you're in the brothels. You're in, there was no marine to brighten stuff up.
Okay. So let's take this one at a time. One of the bright points, I thought, was Brienne and Podrick. We got Brienne's backstory and kind of, I feel like it made Brienne seem more intelligent because I've always wondered whether Brienne actually realized that Renly was gay or whether she was just kind of lovesick over him. But I liked that the show acknowledges that, no, I'm not an idiot. I was loyal to him because he was a person that showed me kindness and he didn't have to. I thought that was great and that gives a really good backstory. And I'm super interested to see how this intersects with, you know, Brienne understanding they're going to Winterfell and what that's going to do. I also kind of like the scene between Littlefinger and Sansa. I don't understand, like, I mean, the pieces are all there. We've seen Sansa unwittingly assassinate a powerful person.
Okay.
You know, be manipulated in doing that. If she's actually on Littlefinger's side, what kind of shit can they pull off in Winterfell?
Probably a lot of shit. I don't know. It depends on how fast Stannis gets down there, I guess. But
and will Brienne kind of fuck that up? And yeah, you've also got this collision course. We got a fort. He marches for Winterfell in a fortnight.
Yeah.
That is very exciting news. I mean, this feels like,
definitely.
I mean, that's. I feel like at episode three, it feels like we're kind of in episode five territory, just based on my preseason thoughts of how this we're going to go.
Everything is more compressed, like you said. It's
which makes me really evaluate how far into the future we're going to get by the end of this season.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But I do like the idea of Sansa having some agency and being able to strike back at her. The tormentors, I don't know. I mean, you know, Littlefinger's in this for Littlefinger, though. So, I mean, this is all rah-rah.
That's the thing. He's openly talking about his ambitious plan.
Yeah.
I'm doing this because I'm an ambitious man with an ambitious goal, and you're part of that. So,
and how much does he really care about Sansa? And if he does care, like, obviously, he puts himself and his pride and ambition first, so... You know, if things go badly for her. And that's the thing. Like, it wouldn't shock me if Sansa gets killed.
Ramsay is a lunatic.
Yeah.
A complete lunatic. So, no, it wouldn't shock me either.
And it's not, I mean, there's wheels within wheels. Like, there's that significant look of, like, Ramsay's number one torture whore. She's not happy about, you know, and, like, you thought Shay was hard on Tyrion?
I don't know what she could do, but
anything, because they're all
there are a lot of things. She's not even, I mean, Sansa's not even supposed to really be there. So
and it's also really good. I mean, the more I talk myself in this episode, the more there's a lot of really good stuff that I miss in the first half because I was getting the taste of the abbreviated version of Janos' execution out of my mouth. But
let me say though, it was very tasty. Like, what? I wanted to see Janos killed from the jump.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, that's what pisses me off the most. I got disappointed by something I wanted to see so bad, you know?
True. I'm super glad that Jon handled the Alistair thing the way he did.
That was very slick.
Yes. And Alistair understands that and appreciates it.
Yeah.
Which is why he steps aside when they go to... lop Janos.
Yeah, and the whole latrine thing, it's like you're waiting, like, oh, he's going to give it
and
to...
he is too. He's looking away from the camera.
He's like, that's what I would do, only probably worse. I also like that they really sold the idea of the Black Brothers being more of a democracy.
Okay.
Like, you know, random brothers can boo and cheer and say shut up, and you know,
the one thing,
like,
you can't do is refuse an order from the Lord.
Damn straight. And that's,
I knew
the thing.
He had it coming as soon as he did that.
Do you think that this is going to quiet, I mean, this is kind of full cast territory, so one of the questions I'm asking myself is this going to quiet Jon's enemies down, or is this going to drive them further underground and make them more dangerous later?
I feel like it's going to have a positive effect for Jon.
Yeah.
Just because now Alistair is kind of aligned behind him.
It feels like.
Or he's at least being pushed in that direction. I don't know if he's totally on board with Jon Snow at this point. But, you know, he proved himself in the battle. Alistair saw that. He has now treated him with...
And a respect.
A respect that, he definitely didn't deserve.
I mean, First Ranger is a very high honor. It's essentially... I mean, I don't know what the second command under Lord. I mean, you've got the Maester. Obviously, he's highly respected, and there's like a first builder. But I feel like with the Night's Watch being a military organization, First Ranger is the A number one position behind Lord Commander.
That's how it felt to me. Yeah.
So that is, you know, essentially making him vice president. That's a big reach across the aisle to him.
And he appreciates it. So I'm looking for good things to happen for Jon in the future. But that's not really a Game of Thrones thing.
Yeah. What do you think about his struggle to maintain neutral? I thought that
struggle to maintain neutral. What are you talking about?
Well, so he vows to take no part in any of the politics of the realm.
Oh, until Davos sticks his hand in there.
Do you think that's going to be, do you think it's going to be enough to nudge Jon into violating his neutrality, especially the fact that he's my next battle is Winterfell, taking it back. Like, this is a big struggle for Jon. Like, where is his duty to the Night's Watch? Where is his duty to the realm? And I liked how Davos helped him appreciate that it's not just a personal glory thing. This is arguably a greater fulfillment of your vows. But then also, what do you do with these 100,000 wildlings?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing. Once Stannis leaves, does Tormund still want to get the wildlings south of the Wall? And if he does, that could be a problem for Jon.
Yeah, and it's a problem for the Night's Watch, because right now they're feeding everybody, and as Jon says, winter is coming. Something has to change. He's put in a position where he cannot just maintain status quo. He has to make bold decisions some way or another.
I'm trying to figure out where he stands on the wildlings coming south of the Wall.
Yeah.
I think he's okay with that, but that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And what do they do once they get south of the Wall? Once Giants and Thin and all of these different factions get south of the Wall, he's got to be worried about the kingdoms then.
Well, and I think making Ollie, that the kid from the northern village that got slaughtered by the wildlings last year, his personal steward, is a really brilliant idea from the show, because that's personalizing the antagonistic feelings that the Black Brothers have towards the wildlings. Like, we saw with some of them, Tormund, Mance, they seem all right.
Yeah.
But the Thins are cannibals, and they look like they're dicks, you know?
Sure.
And the Giants, who knows what their ethos is.
I felt like their treaty here was dubious at best. Like,
sure,
it felt very flaky. Like, the Thins at any moment would turn on people and start eating them and killing them.
I'd
be definitely concerned about that if I were Jon, just letting them go over the Wall.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Toranaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood and the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Why don't we talk about Arya?
That's where I want to go next, too. Sure.
Speaking of dark, dungeony places, man, this house of black and white, it's mostly black in there.
Yep.
It is mostly black.
Yep.
Arya still holding on to the person that is Arya by burying that sword in the rocks.
It's the one thing she just couldn't bear to give up.
Needle. Yeah. Yeah. It felt like too much of a connection to her family, too much of a connection to, you know, the sword guy who trained her. I don't remember his name.
Sirio.
Yeah. They're going to find it. I'm certain the faceless men will know about it. I don't think she can hide it from them.
Yeah. It's mildly interesting.
It seems like she has not fully become the Karate Kid yet.
Right. That's the thing. It's like, you know, when I was watching this, I was like, God, Arya, haven't you seen Karate Kid or any? It's yeah. Like this sweeping the floors. Like, unpaid slave labor is a step one becoming any badass. That's clear. Mm-hmm. I mean, regardless of whether the faceless men find it or not, it's clearly an impediment to her becoming no one.
Certainly.
And, you know, I wonder if this is going to be a eventual repudiation of the faceless men philosophy. Like, maybe you can retain an identity and still be a killer or still have an impact, or maybe she just will take the faceless man training and then reject the philosophy. What is the faceless man philosophy? I mean, we got some
hints
of it.
That's a fair question.
Yeah. What are they actually doing, this House of Black and White? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of all left mysterious.
Yeah, what are these people drinking this water and then passing out, dying? I'm not certain exactly what happens there.
They get put on a stretcher. Uh-huh. They get carried downstairs. They get stripped naked and bathed. And that guy looked pretty dead.
I thought so, too. And maybe that's part of becoming no one, is you become this kind of, like, magical spirit creature who can transform into other people. And maybe that's what Jacket is.
Well, that's what's really cool about the decision to kind of show this as parallel to whatever the hell Qyburn's doing in his cell.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, like, that blew me away. Like, when the Gregor corpse presumably started flopping around, and then Qyburn's just, like, not even concerned. Just shh, it's all right. That, there's a lot of, like, what are they doing to those fucking bodies with magic and all this other kind of necromancy going on? Crazy
yeah,
stuff.
It felt to me like that was some sort of ceremony that signified your becoming a faceless man. But I can't be certain because they don't tell us.
Drinking that and like suffering an apparent death is part of the
yeah.
Meh, I mean, that
seems like it.
Sure. That's all mildly interesting. What do you think about what's going on in King's Landing with the High Sparrows or the Sparrows and the so-called High Sparrow?
I don't know. They seem to be some religious cult who are very concerned about keeping people worshiping the mm-hmm. gods correctly.
Yeah.
And they use humiliation and...
Well, he had a funny
take. It didn't feel like he was super happy with the beating of that High Septon.
Well, I mean, because again...
I feel like humiliation was on the slate and the beating was a little extra.
Yeah, like how... And I guess this guy does seem like a very devout man. Like, yes. He would not want to see his sparrows go too far into justice and to vengeance because mm-hmm. that's a sin in itself. And he seems to be... all about trying to live a life without any kind of sin, mm-hmm. Which is, in you know, kind of scary. You know, someone that uncompromising in their beliefs. But he does seem kind of like a nice guy.
Any ideology taken too far is a scary thing.
Sure. Let's see. What else? Well, let's talk about Tommen. And consummation with Marjorie.
Oh, yeah.
So...
Way to go, Tommen.
How, I mean, Tommen's like, we talked about this last year, like 13, 14 years old.
Sure.
Marjorie's in her early 20s. Mm-hmm. What I think is interesting about this situation is if this was different, if this was a scene between Tyrion and Sansa and they actually did consummate, even if Sansa was willing, I feel like people would be rioting in the streets. But on the other hand, it's like all high fives to King's Tommen and how awesome it is. And I think intellectually that's wrong, but in my heart, I'm wanting to give him high fives too.
Oh, you think it's wrong to high five him?
Well,
I mean, why not just high five Sansa as well? Like, if she's all for it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't know. I'm just saying that there is a double standard there. Hmm. It's the same thing where, like, a high school teacher has sex with a 16-year-old girl and he's a monster. High school teacher has sex with the boy and she and he and both of them is like, everyone's kind of like making a joke out of it.
Yes, I think there's a perception of something inherently unconsensual about that.
Sure.
For a young girl versus a young boy.
And that's part of probably the whole patriarchy power dynamics and all that.
Absolutely. And it's a weird thing.
It is
a double standard. But it is one that is ingrained somehow in our society.
Like 100 years from now, maybe this will be seen as super shocking. Like, maybe. Oh my God, this is like he. How can he possibly give consent? He's just a 13-year-old boy, and he's been, you know, I. But
yeah, you have to also view it from the lens of the show. Which
that's
is
the other thing. Yeah,
fucking 10-year-olds are kings. What do you want? What do you want? Sure. I mean, they're leading men to their deaths in battle. Sure. They can't fuck somebody if they want
to. Sure. And in the books, it doesn't. Like, once a girl got to be of breeding age, then they were married off.
Sure.
Like chattel.
That's just how it was done.
Yeah.
At the time. So you can't get too on your modern societal high horse.
You can't,
when you're watching these shows. But I, mean, I do understand.
You can, but you have to pick. It's kind
you
of.
You can, but I think you're going to look silly if you do.
Sure.
Like, this
sure.
is a fantasy world. There's, it's an old world.
There's things where you can say, I want to apply more social egalitarian look, and it doesn't really matter to the plot. You know, we're talking about, let's have the people of Essos be more racially diverse. And it's not just all brown people with a white person saving them. Fine. Mm-hmm. But this, it's like when you start changing, because that doesn't really affect the story, right?
No.
Dany is there to liberate a people. It doesn't have to be about race.
Sure.
Here, it's all about the sexual power dynamics and what Marjorie's doing. So if you remove this from the plot, it's removing a lot of the mechanics of the story.
Yeah, I mean, you have to believe that she has this vice grip on Tommen. And Cersei is unable. I know. When you have them consummating and Tommen looking as gleeful as he does,
sure,
you believe it.
Yeah.
And you believe that Cersei's grip would not have any effect at this point.
Right.
And that's the point of those scenes. So I don't know that you can get around that.
Marjorie, and also Marjorie seems more benevolent than Cersei.
Okay. Yeah, maybe. I don't really know
what
Marjorie's plan is.
There's a little predatory gleam in her eye, not like sexual predatory, but like I am, you know, when Tommen says, oh, it's so weird to be think of me as the king. And does it seem weird to you? And she's like, oh, so weird. I'm like, no. She's been, I don't know if you've been watching the show, Tommen, but she's been trying to be queen for like 4 fucking seasons now.
For at least 2 kings.
It's like, you know, you want me to fuck a gay guy? Fuck a gay guy. You want me to fuck a psychopath? I'll fuck a psychopath. A 14-year-old boy, bring him in here. Well, fuck him. Like, there is something just as cold and calculating about her ambition as any of, like, the Littlefingers or, you know.
Definitely.
Daenerys's of the world.
I'm totally with you. And my first impression of Cersei's reaction to this was a little surprised that she went to Marjorie and was looking all
what was with that
and defeated. I can't believe that Cersei actually feels defeated here.
No kidding.
And especially because she walks away from that conversation and the girls start giggling and she gets this look in her eye, I felt, which is like doubling down on her determination.
And
to
they also
beat
set that
woman.
Up beautifully when they were in a convoy and like the people were cheering about Queen. They love Queen Marguerite. They're not even, people aren't even looking at Cersei's box or whatever now. And you look at this through her view of her prophecy, where a queen more younger and beautiful is going to. Do you think that she's trying to subvert that prophecy by co-opting Margaery or trying to swallow her? But that's not Cersei.
No, Cersei is kind of power hungry, power mad.
And she's very prideful, and she's also tends to vastly over-inflate her own importance and her skill at doing anything. So
I think she has something up her sleeve.
Yeah.
And getting Margaery off her guard and kind of off kilter is part of that.
Yeah.
She needs Margaery to think that she feels defeated.
Sure. The only other thing to talk about is Tyrion and Essos, who, like, I was screaming at the screen many times. Like, it's one thing to go out and stretch your legs, but do you really does he want to be caught?
Well, if he does, congratulations, because you got caught.
Yeah, well, I mean, like you say, he's essentially saying, hello, I'm a Lannister, used to be rich, do you know.
I always pay my debts. Nudging with the elbow there. It's a bad idea. I mean, but it's Tyrion, right?
Yeah. Do you think I'm honest or am I lying? No, it's, and then having, we've been wondering where Jorah has been kicking around. Yeah. Apparently he's been drinking himself in brothels. I thought that he was going to like get up and stab the dude that's whoring around with the fake Queen Daenerys.
Yeah. He was not happy about that.
But hornswoggling Tyrion and taking her to the queen, which is kind of what everyone wants anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you got to wonder if Jorah wasn't the guy who maybe said, you know what, you kind of look like the queen. Maybe braid your hair, put on a dress an assless dress.
Yeah.
And I might be willing to
indulge
myself.
How many stags has he paid for fake Queen Daenerys?
I don't know what a stag is worth.
It's a silver. I don't either. There's no like, inflation calculating. Is that a number? Like, four? It's worth four.
Is that?
It's worth four. Four things. Four units of whoredom.
I mean, I saw what Davos paid his, you know, sellsword captain guy for his boats, and I was like, that's not a lot, but it seems like that was a big sum.
Sure, and wasn't there, like, cases, like, that was, like...
Yeah, and he said there's more that came from, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. That complicates things
so,
with the path to...
Yeah, the road to Meereen is a little... curvier than Varys.
Because I was wondering how they're going to do this with Tyrion being, you know, former hand of the king and being a big Lannister, and that's with Varys introducing him very subtly.
Yeah.
Jorah comes and he's all bound, like, I found the Lannister asshole that, you know, has brought so much misery to your...
Yeah.
Then it's, you know, I mean...
It's two birds with one stone, right?
Sure.
It gets Tyrion to Meereen, which is something we all wanted, and it gets Jorah... potentially back in the good graces.
That's what he's hoping for.
Certainly.
Do you think it's going to work?
I don't know. That seems like a big risk.
Yeah, because I couldn't judge whether Dany... I mean, I don't know what she's going to do. It's going to be interesting. Well, yeah, like I said, it's... I feel like this is the longest in-cast cast we've ever done, so there's clearly a lot to unpack about this episode.
There is.
But... you know, and as I'm talking myself through, I almost find myself like being more excited and interested by the possibilities. I just, you know, I think I speak for a lot of book readers and that we're just super let down. I'm predicting people be super let down when they see this on Reddit and the forums and whatnot. So
yeah.
Speaking of that, if you'd like to send us your reaction, your ideas of what's to come, send it to GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. You can also participate on our forums, which are cool because you can get in the spoiler thread or the non-spoiler thread, depending on your tolerance for risk and how far along in the books you are. You can keep up with our releases on facebook.com/baldmove and also over on Twitter @baldmove, so you can know the moment that we release these things. Can't wait to see what people think. And it feels like it's going to be a pretty epic podcast on Tuesday. Maybe not. Maybe we've said everything and we'll just be like, okay. But it feels like there's a lot more to unpack.
I think so. Yeah.
All right. So we will see you then.
See you.